You are now listening to the OrthoBullets podcast.
Hey everyone. So before we get into today's episode, we wanted to formally ask you, the good listeners of the OrthoBullets podcast, to take a quick survey about your experience with the podcast so far to give us the feedback we need to continue to make this as valuable of a resource as possible for you. We will have a link to the survey in the show notes. And remember, this is your chance to let us know what you want more of, what you want less of, and what you haven't heard yet on the podcast that you would like to hear in the future. The survey should take you just 2 minutes or less, and if helping us make this free podcast even better isn't incentive enough, we are offering you the chance to win an OrthoBullets Peak subscription for 1 year with the study plan of your choice. And for those that are not familiar with Peak, we will have a link in the show notes so you can learn more. But in a nutshell, with Peak, you will have access to the OrthoBullets Premium Q-Bank, diagnostic exams only available to subscribers, access to over 400 premium videos, including webinars and lectures, as well as all the adaptive learning features that makes Peak such a valuable learning experience. And that's over $125 in value just for taking a 2-minute survey. All you have to do is take a screenshot of your completed survey and email it to info@orthobullets.com for a chance to win. We appreciate your consideration and thanks so much in advance for your feedback about the podcast. And now, without further ado, back to today's episode. This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will be a question session reviewing several high-yield anatomy topics. The questions that will be reviewed appeared on the Basic Science No. 12 specialty exam on the OrthoBullets virtual curriculum. We will include a link in the show notes to take the exam if you have not done so already. The questions included in this episode will be reviewed by Dr. Matthew R. Schmitz, who is a pediatric orthopedic surgeon at the San Antonio Military Medical Center and is also the head team physician for USA Men's Rugby.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to help give this webinar. We'll move right into the first question. A 3-month-old is brought to clinic for evaluation for a right upper extremity abnormality which has been present since birth. Which of the following physical exam findings is associated with the best functional outcome? Obviously, what they're talking about in this question is an obstetric brachial plexus palsy and how to determine which patients are going to have a better outcome in the future. You need to know a few things. First, what are the poor prognostic indicators? One of the first poor prognostic indicator is evidence of a Horner syndrome. Horner syndrome is where you're going to have meiosis and ptosis of one eye with that same side of the forehead being dry. And you can remember that through the acronym MAPE. MAPE is meiosis, or the pupil is constricted, anhidrosis, or lack of sweating, ptosis, or a drooped eyelid, and then inophthalmos, where that eyeball will appear sunken into the orbit. What about some of the other poor prognostic indicators? Well, if you have C5 to C7 involvement, that's going to portray that you are not going to have elbow function and also no wrist function. So if you think about, as we put our hand out in space, to be able to use that hand to feed ourselves or take care of ourselves, you need to have both elbow function and wrist function. And so those patients aren't going to do as well. Obviously, patients that have total plexus involvement are not going to do well. And the other group that falls into that is supraclavicular versus the infraclaviculars. And the way to remember that is that the infraclavicular is essentially distal to the trunks, and so it's treated more like isolated nerve lesions, whereas supraclavicular involves things like the branches C3, 4, and 5 going to the phrenic nerve, etc. And then also remember that Erb's palsies or isolated C5, C6 on the scale tend to do much better. When you have a Klumpke palsy or a C8T1 palsy, those tend to do poorly long term. Remember also, return of biceps function is key. So it's a very good positive indicator of return of global return of function. So the best lesion to have is an isolated C5, C6 lesion that has the best prognosis, especially if they have early biceps return. So if we look at this question, what they're asking is what is going to be the best prognostic indicator? And what you have to choose is the patient's going to have absent shoulder abduction and external rotation with intact wrist and digit flexion and extension. What they're getting is that C5, C6 lesion. Looks like a majority of people answered that. The other one that people answered was loss of hand function with preserved shoulder function. Remember, that's what you're going to see with the Klumpke palsy, meaning that they are not going to have the intrinsic function of their hand, but will have preserved shoulder function. So those actually do poor long term. The proximal extent of the posterior approach, or the Thompson approach to the radius, involves what surgical interval? As we look at some of the approaches to the forearm, remember your volar worker horse is your anterior Henry approach, And then dorsally, you've got your posterior, your Thompson approach. That the interval is between your ECRB, which is innervated by the radial nerve, and your extensor digitorum communis, which is innervated by the PIN. So that PIN comes into play, especially when you talk about how the proximal extent is limited by where that PIN comes out of your supinator. So when you're performing this approach, you actually find the PIN, you dissect it back and find where it comes out of the supinator. But remember, the interval truly is between your ECRB and your EDC, so radial nerve and PIN. And that's what they're asking here. It looks like a majority of people answered that correctly, with a few people saying it's between the ECRL and the brachioradialis. Remember, that's a little bit further over from that, and it's between the EDC and the ECRB. 47-year-old male punches through a glass window and suffers a deep laceration that severs his brachioradialis muscle at the mid-forearm. What nerve is most likely to be injured? And so this, again, is knowing some of your surface and functional anatomy. We know that in the mid-forearm, directly under the brachioradialis, is going to be your radial nerve and then your superficial branch, specifically your superficial branch of the radial nerve. Whenever we do surgical approaches where we have to retract on that brachioradialis, we know that the SBRN is at risk for having a palsy afterwards. So when we look at this question, what they are asking, the only answer that makes sense is the superficial branch of the radial nerve, which everyone was able to answer correctly. During recovery for a radial nerve palsy, what is the last muscle to demonstrate evidence of reinnervation? This is a question that comes up routinely on testing purposes, and it's the order of return of either radial nerve palsies or PIN nerve palsies. And I think it's important to remember some of the relationships between these. Number one, remember that the PIN obviously is a branch of the radial nerve, and so the most distally innervated is going to be the last to return. That makes sense. Well, the most distally innervated is the EIP. When they talk about return to function, that's going to be the last to return to function. When we're looking at some of the other return functions, I think it's important to commit this list, at least the understanding of it, to memory, because they can ask, well, which is going to come first? Is your EDM going to come first versus your EPL or EPB? So remember, the last is going to be EIP. The first is going to be the supinator. In some textbooks, you'll see that ECRB or ECRL are listed, and that can be either the first that's purely posterior interosseous, but more commonly it has dual innervation or it will be listed under a radial nerve. So remember, the last muscle to demonstrate evidence of reinnervation is going to be your PIN, which goes to your EIP. A 4-year-old male falls from the monkey bars and sustains an extension-type supracondylar humerus fracture with a neurologic deficit. Which of the following muscles is most likely affected? So to understand this question, we've got to know a couple of basics that go into our PEDS. Extension versus flexion-type supracondylars. Which nerves are more commonly injured? The most common nerve injury with an extension type supracondylar is the anterior interosseous nerve. A radial nerve or a PIN nerve palsy would be second. If you have a flexion type supracondylar humerus fracture, the palsy that's commonly tested is an ulnar nerve palsy. Okay, so we've determined that this is an extension type. The most common nerve injured is the AIN. So now we need to know what is the innervation of the anterior interosseous nerve. Clinically, we look at FPL and FDS to the index finger, right? But you've got to remember some of the other structures that the anterior interosseous innervates. Specifically, the last one that's listed on this diagram is the pronator quadratus, which is what they were looking for in this test question. So I think it's important to remember, be able to recognize AIN is the nerve that's injured, and then be able to go through that catalog in your mind of which muscles does AIN innervate. It looks like a majority, 3/4 of people were able to answer with the PQ being the correct answer. Looks like FCR, I guess that would be number two, actually pretty evenly mixed. EDC came in there. So again, that's going to be a PIN nerve injury. Remember, that's the second most common. AIN is the most common. And so that's the take home for this. Which of the following unipinnate muscles takes its origin on the radial side of the profundus tendon, inserts on the radial lateral band at the middle phalanx, and creates a force vector that is palmar to the joint of axis of the metacarpal phalangeal joint? So there's a lot of information in this question. What you have to realize is that they are testing lumbricals versus the interossei, okay? So if we go back to our anatomy, and this is a diagram again out of the most recent Miller review, which shows that the first and second lumbricals are, as we work our way from radial to ulnar, the first and second are unipinnate, while the third and fourth are bipinnate. The lumbricals, they originate from your FDP tendons and they insert on the radial lateral bands of the extensor mechanism. And if you think about the intrinsic positive hand, that is the function that your lumbricals help assist with. So they extend your interphalangeal joints, both proximally and distally, while helping flex the metacarpophalangeal joint. They extend the PIP through their insertion on the lateral band, and then they indirectly extend the DIP because the contraction helps release the flexor pull on that DIP. Contrast that to the interossei muscles. Remember, the interossei muscles are going to help with abduction and adduction. The dorsals are going to help with your abduction. Your palmars are going to assist with your adduction. So in this question, if you talk about, you know that they're talking about one of the intrinsics of the hand based on the fact that it came from the FDP and inserted on the lateral band. Then they said that force vector passes volar to the palmar joint axis of the metacarpophalangeal joint. Well, that's another saying that your force vector is going to help flex that metacarpophalangeal joint. So which of the intrinsics helps flex? We know that's going to be a lumbrical. Which of the lumbricals is unipinnate? One and two are unipinnate, whereas three and four are bipinnate. So the answer to this question is the first lumbrical. Looks like people were mixed up a little bit between the first and the fourth. That was the most commonly missed answer. And remember that third and fourth lumbricals are bipinnate. Performing the ilioinguinal approach, what lies between your external iliac vessels and the lateral muscle compartment? So the ilioinguinal approach, again, is used for pelvis and acetabular fractures. There's three windows of that approach. And so after you isolate the external iliac vessels and the iliopsoas tendon, you're able to gain access to all three windows. That medial window is medial to the iliac vessels, and that gives you access to the pubic rami. You can get an indirect access to your anterior SI joint and iliac fossa. The middle window is between your external iliac vessels and the iliopsoas. And the way you dissect that is you have to go through what's called the iliopectineal fascia. That gives you access to the pelvic brim, your quadrilateral plate, and a portion of the superior pubic ramus. And then lateral to your iliopsoas and subsequently the iliopectineal fascia is the lateral window. And that again gives you access to your quadrilateral plate, SI joint, and iliac wing. So the question that they're asking here is what separates the vessels from that lateral muscle group or the iliopsoas? And the answer is the iliopectineal fascia. If we look on this cross-sectional diagram here, we can see that some of the other questions that they are asking are the sartorius. We know the sartorius is farther lateral. The femoral nerve is here, is farther lateral. And specifically, that fascia runs underneath your external iliacs and then wraps in between that and the lateral muscle group or the iliopsoas, okay? And so that was the question that they're asking. It looks like, again, that a majority of people are able to get that with a smattering of people choosing the femoral nerve and the lateral femoral nerve. Remember, that comes off further laterally. The lateral femoral nerve is going to be somewhere around the region in between your ASIS and down to your about one-third of the way down. Some people say 2 centimeters. So again, that's going to be further lateral than the middle window of that ilioinguinal approach. Next is, following an uneventful medial approach to the hip, the iliopsoas tendon is released. Which of the following neurovascular structures is most at risk during release of the tendon? What this is looking at specifically is that medial approach to the hip, essentially most commonly used in Ludloff approach for congenital hip dislocation. There's a few risks you need to know about. The risks include the anterior and posterior divisions of your obturator nerve, but those are usually clearly identifiable as you're going down between your adductor longus and your gracilis draped over top of your magnus. So you can protect those. What specifically comes into play when you perform an iliopsoas tenotomy is the medial femoral circumflex artery. And essentially that is hidden. It's directly underneath as it wraps around. And we'll talk a question about this a little bit later in the webinar. But as that artery wraps around, it is draped right underneath your iliopsoas tendon, and it's a majority of the blood supply to the femoral head. So the medial femoral circumflex comes between your pectineus and iliopsoas. It then circles around and runs between your obturator externus and your adductor brevis, and then proceeds distally anterior to the quadratus femoris, where it's potentially at risk with the posterior approach to the hip. So it's specifically at risk with the psoas tenotomy with that medial approach for DDH. And this is why we look at some of the earlier studies that looked at the Ludloff approach, and they had a significant rate of AVN. It wasn't sure if it was because the hips had been out for so long in these congenitally dislocated hips. Most likely it's due to inadvertent damage to the medial femoral circumflex involved with performing a psoas tenotomy to therefore reduce the hip. Again, it looks like a majority, 3/4 of people were able to answer that correctly. Their obturator nerve is at risk with this. So the rest of the people chose obturator nerve. Again, it is at risk with this, but it's not commonly injured, especially during that release of the tendon, because it's easily identifiable. Which of the following approaches for total hip arthroplasty is reported to have the lowest prosthetic dislocation rate? The answer to this question is the lateral approach to the hip, or the hard hinge approach. And let's talk a little bit about that. For that approach, there's no true internervous plane. You split the gluteus medius. Remember, you want to tag the gluteus medius so that you don't extend past 5 centimeters to protect your superior gluteal nerve. You then detach the gluteus minimus from insertion to gain access to your anterior capsule. There's been a couple of good studies that looked at dislocation rates among the various approaches, and they found that the lowest has been with a direct lateral approach. The first one was from Core in 2002. They showed it was less than, it was just over 0.5% compared to nearly 3.25% with a posterior approach, and that was only improved to 2% when you repaired those posterior structures, similar to 2% for an anterior approach or 1.25% for transtroch. This was repeated in Core of 2006, where again, the results were similar. They showed in a meta-analysis about 0.5% dislocation with a direct lateral versus with what they called improved techniques in this meta-analysis, still a 1% risk of dislocation with posterior. So if they're asking for what is the best in terms of dislocation rates, the best in terms of dislocation rates still to this day remains the lateral approach to the hip or the hard hinge approach. Looks like about half the people got that right. The other half of people chose the anterior lateral. And again, as I quoted in this, and this is from the literature, that it was slightly higher in anterior lateral. So to this day, it still remains that the lateral approach has the lowest reported rates of prosthetic dislocations. The medial femoral circumflex artery and first perforating branch of the profunda femoris artery, anastomose at which of the following locations? So we're talking about the MFCA again. We talked about this before. The MFCA is the primary blood supplier to the adult femoral head. It anastomoses with the first perforating branch of the profunda femoris, just medial to your gluteus maximus insertion. I think this is a very difficult subject to kind of wrap your mind around because it represents a three-dimensional analysis, and we're always studying off of two-dimensional pictures. We know that as the MFCA comes off, we know it's at risk as it runs next to that lesser troch in the front, okay, and that's where we talked about earlier with the ileo-psoas tenotomy. Well, then it comes around and it anastomoses in the back with this first perforator right here down, distal to the intertrochanteric line. And that's where the insertion of the gluteus maximus is. Sectioning of the gluteus maximus during a posterior approach can put both of these vessels and that anastomosis at risk. And so that's the question they're asking for here. Where does it anastomose? And again, it is medial to the gluteus maximus insertion. Looks like about 40% of people answered that right. A large group of people answered medial to the gluteus medius. Now remember, your gluteus medius attaches up near the greater troch, and so what's at risk there would be your retinacular vessels as you move posterior superior. But what they're asking specifically for is the first perforating branch of the profunda. That is further distal and posterior, distal to your intertrochanteric line, and that's why that's the answer. What two nerves make up the internervous plane in the Smith-Pete anterior hip approach? Well, the anterior approach, the Smith-Pete approach, the superficial dissection is between your sartorius and your TFL. Your sartorius is innervated by your femoral nerve, your tensor fasciae latae innervated by your superior gluteal nerve. The deeper dissection is between your rectus femoris and your gluteus medius. The rectus femoris, again, your femoral nerve, and the gluteus medius is your superior gluteal nerve. So the internervous plane for this is the femoral nerve and the superior gluteal nerve. Looks like almost 90% of people were able to get that answer correctly. 67-year-old male with severe hip arthritis presents for evaluation of a total hip arthroplasty. He's requesting a minimally invasive Watson-Jones approach as he has heard postoperatively the mobility is significantly improved compared to a traditional transgluteal technique. What should the patient be told to expect regarding early postoperative gait kinematics when comparing these surgical approaches? So let's review a little bit about the anterior lateral or the Watson-Jones approach. For this one, there is no true internervous plane. You do develop an interval between your tensor fasciae latae and your gluteus medius. Remember from the previous questions, those are both supplied by the superior gluteal nerve. Traditionally, the anterior one-third of your gluteus medius and the entire minimus is then detached. The minimally invasive, or what this patient is requesting, doesn't take down the glutes. And so there's a perceived or potential perceived benefit of less dissection with the theoretic improved outcomes. However, there's been a couple of studies, including a recent review in JBJS of 2010, that looked at 20 patients in both groups and showed that there was no difference in their gait kinematics at 3 months. So although it does provide with less dissection, maybe a smaller scar, there hasn't been a study that's proved inferior gait kinematics with the traditional approach versus the MIS as of yet. And so that's the answer that they're looking for. There is no difference in early gait kinematics between the two approaches. It looks like a majority of people were able to get that correctly, 68%. The next most common was answer four, which is the traditional transgluteal approach results in worse early gait kinematics. And as we showed in that 2010 JBJS study, that has not been proven to be the case as of yet. Injury to the deep peroneal nerve would result in which of the following? Remember that the deep peroneal, sometimes known as the anterior tibial nerve, it runs along the anterior surface of the interosseous membrane and supplies the musculature of the anterior compartment, shown here, the tibialis anterior, your EHL, your extensor digitorum longus, which are shown on this MRI. Remember also that the deep peroneal supplies your peroneus tertius, which is found more distal, and it gives sensation to the first web space. So the answer, if someone has an injury to the deep peroneal, is going to be weakness of great toe extension, which almost everybody was able to get correctly. During total hip arthroplasty via a posterior approach, where is the sciatic nerve most likely to be found? Again, we talked a little bit about this on one of our earlier questions, but remember that in a majority of patients, the sciatic nerve exits inferior to the piriformis and courses posterior, or if you're looking from the back, essentially superficial to your short external rotators. So remember, it comes out from deep to the piriformis and then courses superficial or anterior to the piriformis and posterior to your short external rotators. There was a study in Clinical Anatomy in 2010 that showed there was some slight variation in sciatic nerve anatomy, but 88% of people, so nearly 90% of people, have that prototypical. In some situations, it'll split the piriformis or you'll have a split sciatic nerve, but I think it's important to remember that essentially the sciatic nerve is going to be draped over top of your short external rotators and is going to be coming out of the piriformis, usually at its inferior extent. And so again, that's the answer here. And it looks like 80% of people were able to answer that correctly, with the second most common being answer two, which is superficial to the piriformis and deep. And remember, that's just flip-flopped. And so it's important to remember superficial, we're talking about a posterior approach. And so as you go through, it is going to be deep to the piriformis, even though it's a more anterior structure. Inferior and superior gluteal nerves are designated as such based on the relationship to what structure. This is what we were talking about earlier. So when we talk about the nerves leaving the pelvis, the piriformis is the key to the greater sciatic foramen. What I mean is that the superior gluteal artery and nerve exits superior to that piriformis, whereas almost everything else leaves inferior. How do you remember what leaves inferior is up to you, but I think one of the easiest ones is Pop's IQ. So as we move from lateral to medial, as they exit inferior, you get your pudendal nerve, your nerve to your obturator internus, your posterior femoral cutaneous nerve, your sciatic nerve, the inferior gluteal nerve, and then the nerve to the quadratus femoris. So remember, we're talking about the greater sciatic foramen, the superior gluteal artery nerve leaves superior to your piriformis, which is shown here. Again, it's a very recognizable structure when you're in this region of the body, whereas most everything else leaves here inferior to that. Looks like about 75% of people were able to answer that correctly, with a smattering of choices, the most common being the sacrospinous. And so again, just remember, it's not in relation to the sacrospinous ligament, because the superior gluteal artery nerve actually leave inferior to that sacrospinous ligament, but they are superior to the piriformis. That's what puts them in the greater sciatic foramen, is being inferior to that sacrospinous ligament. Which of the following muscles originates from the ventral surface of the sacrum? So this is, I think it's a difficult question, because they're giving you a list of muscles and asking you to remember where the origins of all them are. But if you think of some key relationships, I think you can help answer some of these questions. When we look at obturator internus and obturator externus, we know that those are going to come off, originate around the obturator foramen. That's why it's in their name. The quadratus femoris is one of the short external rotators, and that is going to be coming off essentially off of the ischial tuberosity and inserting over in your inner troch region. The piriformis, we'll get to in a minute, but then the other one is the superior gemelli, which again is going to be coming from right around the area of the obturator foramen. And the piriformis is coming, you can see it, its origin is here, is on the ventral surface of the sacrum. So by process of elimination, you can answer this question. But I think it's important to, when you look at these, where the origin insertions, to be able to pick out some key things. The piriformis is essentially the only structure that comes off that side of the sacrum, so that would make it a very testable item. Again, when we talked about the psoas originating on your transverse process of L1 through L5, that's unique. That could potentially be a testable question, like they're asking here. So it looks like about two-thirds of people are able to get that correctly, and I think we showed in that previous diagram why the other answers are wrong. The most commonly was shown was the obturator internus. Remember that the origin of that obturator internus is going to be right around the obturator foramen. Which of the following nerves innervates the short head of the biceps? The biceps is one of those muscles that has a short head and a long head, and it receives innervation from two separate parts of the sciatic nerve. Remember that the short head is innervated by the peroneal division, while the long head is innervated by the tibial division. And the way I remember that is PS and LT, Lieutenant LT. So PS, peroneal, short head, LT, long head, tibial division. Looks like a majority, 3/4 of people were able to answer that with the other people getting mixed up between the peroneal and tibial divisions. So remember, PS, peroneal division, innervates your short head. LT is the long head innervated by the tibial portion. Hunter's canal is bordered by what two muscular components? Hunter's canal runs deep to the sartorius, and it runs between your anterior compartment and your medial or your adductor compartment. So when we start off up, and I think that if you think about it in a sense that the femoral vessels are, they come off anteriorly, all right, underneath the inguinal ligament, and then Hunter's canal essentially, as you move more distally, the medial compartment maintains its relationship to those vessels, meaning it stays posterior to those vessels. Even though the vessels themselves course to a more posterior direction, they still stay in front. They don't pierce through the adductors until they get down to the canal. So that's why it's between the anterior compartment, your knee extensors, and then your medial compartment, which is the adductors. And it looks like, again, a majority of people are able to answer that correctly. The second most common being the medial and posterior compartments. And just remember that the medial compartment is always going to be posterior to those vessels. So they have to be between the medial and the anterior. During a total knee arthroplasty using a standard medial parapatellar approach, if a lateral release is required, special attention should be made to preserve which of the following arteries? We know that the medial parapatellar approach essentially violates all of the medial blood supply to the patella. If you combine that in the sense of doing a total knee, when you resect the fat pad for visualization, when you resect the meniscus, that leaves essentially only the superior lateral genicular artery as the only remaining blood supply to the patella. So you need to be cautious with your lateral release to specifically try and save that superior lateral genicular artery. Because as we mentioned, as you take out everything else, specifically in the setting of a total knee arthroplasty, that's going to be the only remaining blood supply to the patella. And so that's the answer there. It looks like, you know, almost 90% of people are able to answer that correctly. What is the internervous plane for the posterior lateral approach to the tibial shaft? Well, the posterior lateral approach, the interval is between your soleus and your FHL, and that involves the tibial nerve, and then between your peroneals, which are the superior peroneal nerve. So you detach the FHL from its origin on the fibula, you detach the tib post from its origin on the interosseous membrane to reach the tibia. What's at risk is the neurovascular structures of that posterior compartment. What you can see here is in red, I've got the anterior tibial artery, obviously in the anterior compartment. You have your peroneal nerve and artery and vein, excuse me, which are just posterior and just medial to your fibula. And then in between your superficial and your deep posterior compartments is where you have your posterior tib artery and vein. So the neurovascular structures at risk specifically are all those of the posterior compartment, but you have to pay special attention to those, to the peroneal artery. So what you're doing is you are taking off the FHL from its origin, and we've got the lateral compartment there. So as you can see here, you take the FHL off its origin, then you use that to protect your peroneal artery and vein. You take the posterior tib off its origin, off the interosseous membrane, and that gives you access to the posterior lateral aspect of the tibia. Remember also, another question that comes up in relation to this is the relationship between your FDL, your posterior tib, and your FHL. Remember, your FDL is going to be on the more tibial side, with that posterior tib muscle being midline, or essentially coming off your interosseous membrane, and the FHL is the most lateral. So the answer again was between your tibial and superficial peroneal nerves, which nearly 90% of people were able to get correct.
That's all for this anatomy question review session. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you tomorrow.